Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Designing Longitudinal Research in Complex Multiprofessional Environments conference, organised by the Scottish Child Care and Protection Network. This talk was recorded on the 20th of April 2011. Ruth Gilbert, Centre for Evidence-Based Child Health, Centre for Paediatric Epidemiology and Biostatistics, and MRC Centre of Epidemiology for Child Health, University College London, Institute of Child Health, using routine healthcare data for longitudinal analysis.
I'm going to talk about using routine healthcare data for longitudinal analyses of child maltreatment. And I mean, this is something we've been working on for the last 3 years, really. And it's rather confined to English data, the work that I'm going to present to you, although as a follow-up to the Lancet series, we were commissioned then to do a six-country comparison, which we've just done and finished and is with the reviewers. But so it is spinning off into international comparisons, but I'm really going to be talking largely about English data. And I thought, as I started, why I should just say why health when we're dealing with child maltreatment. And I think there's a number of reasons. First of all, you know, children may present to healthcare with signs or symptoms relating to child maltreatment. So it's a major front line for recognising and responding to child maltreatment. Although, as you all know, that's relatively little of child maltreatment will be recognised by healthcare services, or is at the moment. A second reason is that maltreated children are at high risk of other chronic illnesses and comorbidities and disabilities and mental health. So they carry with them many health problems. So the input of healthcare is extremely important to the well-being of these children. The third reason, as you all know, and was sort of covered in one of the first of those Lancet papers, is that the long-term consequences of child maltreatment really impinge on health in adolescents and in adult life. And there's very good prospective cohort data now showing that. The fourth reason, and I think Paul was starting to touch on this morning, is that, of course, parental health problems are one of the main factors affecting parents' ability to adequately parent and therefore leading them to maltreat their child, by which the term maltreatment, I include abuse and neglect here, and all forms of abuse. I take that as a given in this audience. And so recognition through parents is an important way of recognising maltreatment, preventing it, and responding to it constructively. And I feel that that's an area where we've touched very little on, actually, but it's one of the main opportunities, I think, for healthcare to contribute to improving the lot of maltreated children and indeed preventing it. So that's why healthcare. Paul's covered this very much better than I will in this single slide. But one of the differences from cohort studies of routine data is that it captures use of services, not what happens. And so it's really not very good for etiological questions, which is why I sort of was asking Paul about what's the question, because that's really important for, you know, what data you want and how you design it. Because it's only capturing the tip of the iceberg, in fact, because it's capturing use of services and often serious outcomes. And then thirdly, a big disadvantage is that it's strongly affected by coding practices or recording practices or thresholds for recording anything, and so on and so forth. So there's, contrary to your yearly follow-up, there's no standardised questions at standardised time points so that everyone's been asked. It's just who hits the rate, who hits the services, and then there's all sorts of process problems of, you know, is it recognised, is it recorded, is it coded? And that's what you're picking up at the end. So there are major limitations. But an advantage, as Paul very clearly said, is that it avoids loss to follow-up. And this is one of the big downsides of prospective cohort studies, as he said, But you don't have that problem providing you're casting the net wide enough on a national or regional basis so that you're able to get people that move within the area. So but it will miss non-users of services, which I think we know very little about with child maltreatment, but I think there is a possibility that there is underuse of healthcare services, certainly, among them. And then the other big advantage, of course, is that it can be population-based. Okay. The other thing I just that we've been struggling a lot is with coding practices is this problem of reluctance to name maltreatment and to code child maltreatment, and that's related to the pejorative nature of the condition, but also to very real problems associated with increased access of parents to children's notes and of children to their notes, if not now, in the future when they become 18. So that's a real impediment. In relation to, I was just going to give you a little run through of what's available in healthcare. Hospital administrative data has been going for longest, is most standardised, and you have pretty much the same in Scotland as you do in England. In England, it's called Hospital Episode Statistics, and it covers all admissions to the NHS in England, and you have something similar in Scotland. And the strongest of this, though, in Scotland, I mean, I have to say, you've got much better data because it's been going for much longer. We've got pretty good usable HES data since 97. You've got data going back to 1980, I think. What's best is the hospital admission data, which, again, is the tip of the iceberg because, lots of children may come to A&E or outpatients but not be admitted. And all of that is ICD-10 coded, so coded in a standardised way. And this is what we've exploited in the six-country comparison that I just mentioned, because people are using these codes around the world in a pretty similar way. A&E and outpatient department data, of course, affect many more children, many more hospital contacts, and really important to get at. But in England, they've only really been going since 2007, and they're really poorly coded, and they're not being coded in the same way. So we have dates, and that's very useful. So you have to sort of be pragmatic and use what you can. But we don't have good codes about what the reason was for attendance or any other concerns. This is what I'm going to sort of present to you mainly. In a little while. Just running through the other sources of data, there's child health data, which relates to birth notifications and other interventions that would be provided in the community, like vaccinations, and it will carry some information about disability, but is not, as far as I know, linked to hospital administrative data at all, certainly not in England. I'm not sure if it is here. And then there's other data, such as child and adolescent mental health service data, CAMS, which, again, is very variable and not linked to anything else. But I believe in Scotland there's a bit more linkage of psychiatric outpatient data. Is that right? You didn't cover that in your previous seminar, but anyway. Okay, then perhaps the most rich data of all, but the most messy and difficult to use, is primary care data. And of course, as you know, something like 95% or 90% of healthcare contacts are with primary care. On average, a child under two will see their GP five or six times a year. And the GP will usually be seeing at least one other parent, usually the mother, and other household members. And they will be able to link on the screen in front of them between household members. So that record that the GP has provides a longitudinal record of what the child has been to the GP for, and they can also then flick into other household members and see information about parents if they want to. These are clinical databases where the GP codes the reason for the consultation, they code the prescription. The prescriptions, any drug prescriptions, are automatically coded, so they're very good in primary care data. But the coding is extremely messy. Although primary care databases, now one we're using to look at child maltreatment in England, covers about 6% of the population in England, it's called the Health Improvement Network. There's others like GPRD and Q Research that now cover in a substantial proportion of the population. They're very difficult to use because of this variability in coding among GP practices and among GPs themselves. So it's really sort of much more of a sort of fishing expedition for codes that might reflect child maltreatment. And we're doing some work on that at the moment, but we're not far ahead enough to tell you anything about it. And then, of course, deaths are a really important outcome that you want to be able to access, and that's very often can be linked to hospital administrative data, and that's pretty easily done now. So before I move on, let's just sort of review what the questions are. I did have a question slide, but got deleted in my travelling up here. and the questions, I think, as Bridget mentioned right at the start, I think first and foremost, when you're using routine data, are how can we use this data to improve the quality of care? It's really a very applied question of, you know, who are we seeing? What is the burden? How does it vary between hospital trusts and what happens to them? But all really related to improving the quality of care. So I suppose I'm a sort of very applied clinical epidemiologist, and that first of all, you know, I'm not so interested in the etiological questions. I'm interested in how can we use this to improve the care that's provided now for these children. And the great thing about using routine data is, of course, it's the data that is available to the hospital trusts to monitor their own performance. And, you know, some of the data will be there for individual clinicians to assess the risk of children and you know, generate predictive models. That's rather futuristic. But by using this routine data, that's where you can go with it. That you can, you know, not only find out, questions about quality of care and how it varies between different trusts, but you can also develop predictive models to then identify high-risk, low-risk children and help to inform clinical decisions about individuals or about, you know, groups of children. So I think it's very rich in that way. And, of course, the other questions relate to sort of public health and policy, such as, you know, who's being affected, how is that changing over time, are broad policy initiatives associated with those changes, and, of course, the question I've just looked at, which is in how do these trends vary between countries. Okay, so that's healthcare data. In order to understand what we might be wanting to detect, we first of all need to look at what is actually happening. How do we know what is actually happening in child maltreatment? Well, the best data on this are self-report and parent report studies. And I'm just showing you one here from David Finkelhor's group in America, where they've sampled several thousand children over the age of 10 and their parents under the age of 10 and asked them a number of questions about adverse things happening to them, which he puts under the heading of victimisation. So if it's assaults, abuse, name-calling, scapegoating, and so on by a parent or a carer, then that will come under the heading of maltreatment. But as you know, as children get older, by far the sort of the biggest burden on them is victimisation by peers, strangers, and other adults in their environment. And for many maltreated children, their exposure to adverse life events is part of a continuum. So not only will they be being maltreated in a number of different ways, that they will also be the kids that will be being victimised in a number of different ways. And what David Finkelhor's study showed was that when he measured multiple exposures to victimisation, 11% of this representative population of children had had five or more exposures to victimisation in the past year. What I wanted to just show you on this rather complicated slide is that, of course, as children get older, if you're looking at actually what maltreatment is happening to them, then look at this line, it increases with age. So that's physical, emotional, sexual abuse or neglect. The exposure increases with age. But if we were to look at data from social services, of course, we'd see the reverse of that. We'd see a much greater focus in the younger ages than in the older ages for a whole variety of reasons, but partly because a kid being hit when they're younger is much more vulnerable to serious injury or death than a kid being hit when they're older. But so this is a good barometer of what's happening, and that's what we need to keep an eye on when we then look at more tip-of-the-iceberg data, such as in healthcare, education, social services, or nobody's mentioned it yet, but the judiciary. I think it's coming up tomorrow, isn't it? So this graph shows you that, you know, maltreatment pales into insignificance, not insignificance, but it's relatively a low proportion of the burden of things happening to children. And I think healthcare has a responsibility to be dealing with these other things as well, and because they can be just as damaging. Okay, so that's the what we know is happening, and I'm just going to take that. I mean, what David Finkelhor came up with was that about 10% of children a year are exposed to child maltreatment, so victimisation by carers, so neglect or child abuse, about 10%. An NSPCC study has used some of the tools from David Finkelhor's surveys and just published a couple of months ago, and they came up with a figure of 4%, again based on, can't remember how many it was, but 1,000 or so, something like that. But they weren't measuring things in quite the same way. So anyway, we're somewhere between 10% and 4%. So this graph is my way of showing you that 10% of children. So these 20 bars represents 10% of children. So just to see how they'd come to the attention of services, in that Lancet series that Bridget mentioned, we did a review of developed countries, and we came up with the figure that between 1.5% and 5% of children are reported to child protection services each year. So 7 of these maltreated children would get above that bar. In England, it's now over 5% of children are referred to social services each year, but not all of those will be for child maltreatment. And the way they collect the data, they can't tell us what proportion are for child maltreatment. Unfortunately, it's very annoying because some will be for disability and so on. Okay? Around 1 to 3% will be investigated each year. Since the Baby Peter issue, then investigation rates have gone up to, I think, about 65% now. But at the time we did the review, then it was around 55% in England of children that were referred to social services actually got an investigation. An initial assessment is what it was called in England. So around 2.5%, 3% in England. And around 1% would be substantiated. It's a little bit different, a bit lower for us in England. We use child protection plan is sort of more or less similar to substantiation in the US, Australia, New Zealand and Canada. And it's around sort of, I think it's around 0.4%. A year at the moment. So 2 children of our 20 would be substantiated. And then around one of them would be placed in out-of-home care. The point of showing you this is to point out that there's a lot of children below the bar who never get above the bar, who never come in contact with child protection services or social services, but are still being maltreated, who will be being seen by other services, healthcare, education, and the judiciary. And, I mean, I'm only dealing with healthcare and a relatively small part of that for hospital admissions, but you can see there's a really big problem. And the other way of looking at this graph is to not say that's 20 children, but to say this is one child that's been maltreated over their childhood. And we all know here that child maltreatment, when it really matters, is a chronic condition. It's not events. It's not single events that you just need to respond to on a, you know, just there and then it's solved. For children that are going to have consequences, child maltreatment is a chronic condition. And so over this child's lifetime, they may have come to attention at birth and then a bit later, but then had, you know, grumbled on, the maltreatment's still going on, but most of the time they're not under follow-up by child protection services, but they are seeing other services who need to be responding. All right, so going back to hospital data, so hospital administrative data, and which is based on ICD-10 codes, as I told you. Now, the key issue here is how the hell do we measure child maltreatment in hospital administrative data when you've got children that come in, say, with an injury, and I'm only going to be talking to you about injuries because that's where we've started, and there's concerns about isn't this child maltreatment? And, you know, this is a terribly uncertain diagnosis for paediatricians. How might those concerns be recorded? Well, at the top, so we've gone into this and we've looked at a variety of ICD-10 codes. We've now looked at externally validated what we're finding in the HES data set with other data sets in England, and then compared those rates with other data sets in other countries, and we're getting similar rates. So we think these are pretty reasonable ballpark codes to be using. We're in the process of doing the internal validation, which is to then take cases that have these codes and go into the hard copy records and see whether they really are or not. But the gist of it at this point in time is that I think these are highly specific. So if they say there's a problem, there's likely to be a problem, I think they're pretty insensitive. So any rates that we get from this are likely to be underestimates of the true rates of problems. So that's as much as I know at the moment. But what we've done is to divide the codes up, don't worry too much about all of these, into, you know, true blue maltreatment syndrome, which, you know, is highly pejorative, putting this down, and assault, which particularly in children under 5 or children under 10 even, assault, if a child's assaulted by anyone, then that's really a marker of child maltreatment. And then there's these measures of explicitly undetermined cause. This isn't just I don't know. This is, you know, we don't know and we need to do a test to find out or whatever. And then there's a whole range of codes reflecting uncertain adverse social circumstances. So that's what you have to do. And there's a lot of work in coming up with measures that you can draw out of these routine data. And it's much more difficult for the GP data. This is relatively straightforward. Okay, and these percentages, so this is adding up to just over 2%. And this is the proportion in children admitted under 5 with an injury, just over between 2 and 3% will have had one of these, what we call maltreatment-related codes. So that's how we're measuring it. Okay, and here's some work that we did that was published in the archives last year, Archives of Disease and Childhood. And this is for children under 1 year old, infants basically. We're showing that injury admissions in infants, we're seeing a really steady rate from 97 to 2008, which is what we had the data up to then. So not much change, and just over 6% of infants who were admitted with an injury had a maltreatment-related code. And we then went into doing sensitivity analysis. What if we're talking about intracranial injury, which everyone knows is a really high-risk injury for shaken baby syndrome and for child maltreatment? Then we see that going up to sort of close to 20%. And if we're looking at fractures of the long bones, which in children who can't walk, you know, is also an alarm sign, then we see these codes going up. So we think, you know, they are measuring something related to maltreatment, at least. And then in the 1 to 3 year olds, lower rates, and lower rates in the 3 to 5 year olds. So pretty much what we'd expect, if you're thinking of the sort of social services data, you know, high risk early on and then going down, and but steady, absolutely steady. We're not really seeing much change over time at all there. But what we were seeing was this change, this coding drift. And really, certainly since sort of 2002, but perhaps a little bit before, this decline in the use of these maltreatment syndrome and assault codes, these highly pejorative codes, and this increase in codes related to adverse social circumstances. But in total, the rate is remaining the same. And I mean, this just demonstrates some of the problems of using routine data. There's two explanations for this downward drift. One is a coding explanation, in that that it may be related to requirements for that a diagnosis is either definite or probable, that was brought in the early 2000s. So coders may have been coding it less. The other is, of course, the problems that happened to two paediatricians who were taken to court over accusing parents of child maltreatment. And, you know, there's been a general problem among paediatricians of being more reluctant to put their heads on above the parapet in terms of making claims about child maltreatment. So those, and we don't know which it is. I suspect coding is the bigger issue. But it just shows that you need to be very flexible and, you know, really do some background work about what codes are used. Okay, so the last picture I showed you was just up to 5 years. And now I've sort of taken off the wrappers and extended it up to 18. And here, this is very interesting. We're using the same codes, and you see kind of a bit of a reflection of what you saw in that Finkelhor graph, where maltreatment and other forms of victimisation really shoot up as children go into school age. So we're seeing in these you know, more definite coding groups, assault or maltreatment syndrome just really going up in these older children. And this drop-off, which we think is because you get paediatric coders before 16 and you get adult coders after 16. And we don't see this drop-off in Western Australia data. They do it the same. So I think we've really got a problem here with adult services. But what this is telling you is the really vulnerable groups are these adolescents. And those two put together gives you all victimisation-related, whether it's by carers or others, and it's this J-shaped curve where this group is, you know, relatively small compared to this big problem here. And just going back to how we use this information to improve service or for service provision, this is really important information for service providers. So victimisation-related injuries are nearly one in five of all injury admissions for adolescents aged 18. That's one in 360 people each year aged 18. So that's pretty high. I think this is Oh, no, this isn't on. I'm not letting you have this slide because it's not published yet. So you can write it down. But important information when thinking about, you know, what services do we need to provide in hospital, and particularly at a time when social workers are being stripped out of hospitals. And if we add to victimisation-related injury, self-harm and ingestions, this is how it goes up. So that's the total. And there we're dealing with 38% of all injury admissions are either related to victimisation or self-harm at the age of 18. Now, we have services in place for child protection. We have child protection teams and named nurses, named doctors. When you look at this, you see, it really begs the question of what services do we have in place to respond to these social welfare issues, which I think is associated with really very high rates of subsequent injury and death, and in themselves are pretty harmful. Okay, so that's how we can use this routine data to inform quality of care. The other question I mentioned was, you know, to deal with the public health question of how can we use these data to see how things are changing over time. And a particular issue with maltreatment-related data is you've kind of got to piece these things together. And this is one of the graphs from the work we've just done of the six-country comparison. So this is just infants for England. And here we have violent deaths. So this is a log scale, by the way, because these rates are very different. So here we have violent deaths. As you know, there's a paper just out very recently reporting that violent deaths in infants are going down. So that looks like a decline, and it is a significant decline. Here in blue, we have the maltreatment-related injury admissions, which, as I said, is absolutely flat. And here's the maltreatment syndrome and assault going down a little bit. And here we have child protection plans for infants. So going up a little bit, and particularly that blip at the end related to baby P. Neglect here, child protection plans for neglect going up, and then child protection plans for physical abuse going down and then blipping up after the baby Peter. So we're not able to have data for so long with the cause specific. And as you know, there's all sorts of problems with how that cause gets allocated. But we have child protection plans or child protection register for that for longer. So you can start to see, you know, putting all these things together, which direction are trends going in? Well, right at the severe end, tiny numbers, but going down. But in terms of who is coming to the attention of child protection services, going up. And just the nutshell message is we're seeing pretty similar things elsewhere in other countries. Okay, so that's the questions about trends. The other question, of course, is what happens to these kids? Because we've got longitudinal data from routine healthcare data, we can start to look at outcomes. So, for instance, you can do something like take a maltreatment-related index injury admission, so, you know, a maltreated an injury admission. You can look forwards within the administrative data to look at outcomes such as unplanned acute admission for any reason, unplanned acute admission for injury. If the data are linked to deaths, so not just deaths in hospital, deaths at any time, you can look at mortality. And if it were linked to social care, I wish, then you could look at this. And you know, certainly groups that we've been working with in Australia and in Canada, in Manitoba, then they are linked to social care referrals. And we've been looking at that relationship. And, of course, the other thing you have is really interesting information. That word says predictors there. You know, what's other previous admissions or numbers of A&E attendances or outpatient visits, before that maltreatment-related admission, or even after it, that might help clinicians work out, is this a high-risk case or a low-risk case? To deal with that question that we're all obliged to deal with when dealing with child maltreatment, which is to assess future risk of harm. And at the moment, there's no formal, quantitative way in which anyone assesses future risk of harm. But now with these data, and this small population, they're only a tiny proportion of children that are seen by social services, you could start to use, by developing predictive models, you could start to use these data to construct predictive models so that when clinicians are discharging this child where they've got concerned about the injury, they're not just, the child survived to discharge, so they're not worried about what's happening in hospital, but their job hasn't finished because they need to decide about future management. You could then start to use these predictive models to help you assess, do I really need to team them up with, you know, a team in the community, or is this one I can just ring the GP and let go? So that's one of the possibilities there. Just to say a little bit about what proportion child maltreatment related injuries are of all of them. We have some data from Western Australia where they've got a very well organised system with child protection services, you know, actually kind of living next to the A&E department. So, and it's just that one children's hospital. It's amazing. But 2/3 of those children that come in with a maltreatment related injury have contact with children's social services at some point in their lives. This is looking at children under 11. Whereas of children referred to social services, only 2.5% had ever had a maltreatment-related injury. All right, and you all know this. I mean, we've all, paediatricians, I'm a paediatrician, have dominated the field of child maltreatment to make you think about injury, injury, injury. Injury is a tiny proportion of the way children present to services of any sort. I'm sure you know that, but we've got some figures for it now as well. Okay, So just thinking about what else can be done with linkage to children's social services. Well, I've had to draw on examples from other data sets. And this is data from Western Australia. So, you know, what they've been able to do is to take entities like, you know, children seen, this is a study based on neonatal withdrawal syndrome, which is where you have to, where babies are born with drug withdrawal symptoms from, you know, because their mothers are drug users. And then follow them up to look at, you know, do they get referred to social services and how long does it take? And compare them with, because they've got very rich linked data, they can adjust for all sorts of risk factors such as demographic risk factors and socioeconomic data and aboriginality and so on and so forth. And you know, adjusting for all those sorts of things, and they were able to see that, you know, roughly these children had a sort of 10 times higher risk of being referred to children's social services in the next year. But so that's an interesting question to answer, but it's also a tool for quality control, for looking at quality of services. And the other example I pulled out was Sweden, of course, have been linking data longer than anyone. Somebody called Franken has done some very nice papers. Franken with Vinalum here is one of them. And they've linked social care data and healthcare data. And one of the things that they looked at was care, children being placed in care, either being in care, so I think that's like a supervision order here, in home or out of home, during adolescence, and the risk of teenage pregnancy, which was, you know, very much higher than the baseline risk for children with similarly deprived. I think if we were dealing with a similarly deprived population here, we'd have a much higher rate than 3% of teenage pregnancies, but that's Sweden for you. Okay, so there's examples of how you can answer very relevant questions that are not just interesting to researchers, but are interesting to to social services, because what this was revealing was that when they looked at children that had been placed in care before their teenage years, they had a much lower rate of teenage pregnancy, and certainly the ones that have been in long-term care also had a very low rate of teenage pregnancies. And it was this group placed in care during teenage years that were really, really high risk. So, you know, it gives, that's very informative for services. Okay, so just to finish up with a couple of slides, first on the limitations of using routine hospital administrative data. Well, one of the things is you have to pick your conditions that can be measured, and at the moment we're working on injury, and that's an uncommon manifestation of child maltreatment. And I'm becoming more and more aware, and we're doing some work at the moment to look at this. I think injury is not even the main manifestation of child maltreatment in hospitalised patients. We haven't got any paediatricians here, but paediatricians are spending most of their, and the hospital social workers where they exist, are spending much more of their time on children with chronic illness and serious disability, and that's where the big worries are about child maltreatment, actually, I think, but I haven't got the data to present you with that. We're doing a bit of work at the moment. The other problems, as I mentioned, neglect is poorly coded, but probably recognised. What we're seeing with the work with GPs is that it seems to be quite well recognised, but there's issues about how that's captured. Emotional abuse, we know, is not well recognised or well coded. And then this problem that we're starting to hint at is that we should remember there is probably a problem of underuse of services by some maltreated children, because they have higher needs, so you'd expect them to be using services more. But if you given those disadvantages, if you've been able to link routine healthcare data to a cohort study, then you can, you know, have the strengths of both. And the big strength, of course, of having the routine data in there is that it provides data on high-risk children who are otherwise lost to follow-up in the cohort studies. And, you know, that happens, and it's a really big disadvantage of prospective cohort studies. The other thing is that you have this fantastic comparator population. So just like I just showed you with that Swedish study, you know, they were able to just take the data set for children that had been in care in home or out of home and link it to healthcare data and to all the other population register data that they have. And then immediately they have a comparator population. So they're able to say, given this level of deprivation, lone parenthood, they even, you know, had other things about, you know, even the parents, whether they were teenagers as well, you know, then what is the risk of these kids having a teenage pregnancy over and above all those other factors that you're concerned about? So it's very, very strong, gives you a comparator population. The other thing is that it's generalizable. It gives you answers that are generalizable to the population seen by services. So, as I said at the beginning, the weakness is it doesn't tell you what's actually happening, but it tells you what comes to the attention of services. So it provides information, as I said, you know, about the sort of mortality risk and so on of children that you're discharging from hospital, which is really important for clinicians, you know, at that point. Another big advantage is that we've heard some discussion of, you were saying about retrospective cohorts, and I think Paul was explaining some of that. But of course, you can, as he said, you can link forward or backward to important events in healthcare data, such as, you know, forwards or backwards to death, injury, teenage birth, mental health, chronic illness, and so on. And if you're able to, you can do that for the parents. And I think this is a really important area that we can do at the moment with mothers in GP data. But may be possible with your linked data in Scotland. And lastly, it's very efficient because it's cheap. And I just want to underline, as a last word, how extremely informative linkage to social services data would be. Thank you very much.
This recording is copyright of IRIS 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licenses, attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 2.5, UK Scotland license. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.